to replace galvanic fabric. Even if only in the order of appearance, is both an honor and a burden I could not refuse. Two contingent facts are of particular importance in the context of my talk. The first fact is that I am a moral philosopher. My basic commitment and loyalty as a philosopher is moral philosophy or ethics. The second fact is that I became acquainted with Wittgenstein as a research student, as our chairman just said, in Cambridge in 1949. I never heard him lecture, and we talked very little about philosophy. Nevertheless, he left a very profound impression on me as a moral philosopher. My talk, therefore, will be subjective in a very straightforward sense. It is about me and my reflections on Wittgenstein, his life and his philosophy. But most of all, perhaps, about some general problems of philosophy which have surfaced in my mind in connection with my encounters with Wittgenstein, encounters live and on paper. More occasionally, I also refer to what others have written about the same topics. This is not the scholarly type of thing, as you see. I should add to this that I'm not much of a Wittgenstein scholar, partly perhaps because he did not write much about ethics. But how much or how little Wittgenstein wrote about ethics may be a bone of contention, depending on how one understands, how one views and understands the relationship precisely between Wittgenstein's life and his philosophy. And he did have a view of life, eine Lebensanschauung, which, as I see it, expressed itself in his non-philosophical life and conduct. Cases in point are how, during two world wars, he radically changed his way of life or his way of living. He once said to me when the First World War broke out in 1914, he either ought to enter a monastery or volunteer for war service. He chose the latter, and emphatically so, as we all know. A feeling underlying the theme that I have chosen for my talk is that it is difficult or even impossible to draw a line between his philosophical life as a writer and teacher of philosophy and his non-philosophical activities. Our walks along the River Cam may, I suppose, qualify as instances of his non-philosophical life, or as borderline phenomena. Those walks were in no way speechless, but they were almost, but not quite, philosophy-free. And I wonder whether some such distinction holds for all philosophers. It surely does. I mean, some distinction between your professional life and your personal life. It surely does for many other academic professions or vocations. For physicians, it's almost a duty. And lawyers, same there. And automobile mechanics, to just choose completely at random. Two not very clear questions about the relation between human life and philosophy in a more general sense are basic to my work, my talk. They may be particularly pressing. Is that all right? precisely for one who is a moral philosopher. One, what does, is the following, what does or can philosophy do to or for the philosopher whose philosophy we're talking about? And the second question is, what can or cannot a philosopher's philosophy do for others? Not for the philosopher himself, herself, but for others. First, some remarks to the first question. When, in 1993, Professor van Wricht published, I quote, a fragment of an intellectual autobiography, end of quote, under the title, Philosophy is My Life. He was, at that point, he was making use of a statement Wittgenstein had made while he lived in von Wright's house in Cambridge not long before he died. It seems to me that that would be the most a philosopher could do for, or be for any philosopher. But still, it's not quite clear to me what this amounts to say, philosophy is my life. If I were to say that, the same about me and my life, my wife would ask me, how many lives do you have? In the Myth of Progress, where this quotation is taken from, as in his recent autobiography, he translated the title, My Life as I Remember It. He tells us, von Wright tells us, that at the age of 13, it became, I quote, clear to me that philosophy was my calling. Both these books that I've quoted from now are in Swedish. And one of the many advantages of being Norwegian is that then you can also read Swedish. I do not know quite how to make, what to make of this. From the next foreknowledge, if you will, or what, I don't know what word I should use, that he was going to be a philosopher. He had to become a philosopher. I don't quite know what to make of this. Is this the road to philosophy all philosophers travel? Personally, I would sooner have to say that at the age of 35, when I got my PhD, I discovered, somewhat to my surprise, that I had become a philosopher. And that, at 83, I still am. Let me turn back to the impact of my encounters with Wittgenstein. Although I was then very much a newcomer to philosophy, special reasons for that, Wittgenstein, as I said above, made a powerful impression on me, although we never talked about philosophy, and only occasionally about philosophers. One consequence of that impact was that even after his death, I did not trust myself to read Wittgenstein. I thought I wouldn't understand anything of it. And when 10 years later or so, I did read the Tractatus. It actually took that long before I got my courage up to do that. I could not help reading the Tractatus with my own picture of Wittgenstein in the background. What puzzled me then was the apparent fact that many of those, I was in Cambridge, that many of those who at that time did read and write about Tractatus, apparently did not take seriously what the author said about ethics and other such topics that were neither logic nor the philosophy of logic. The title of the thing is Logisch Philosophische Abhandlung. And then not the world, but what Tractatus says about ethics and the world, and then not the world in the sense of alles was der Fall ist. everything that is the case. It's the first proposition in the Tractatus. I found it actually next to impossible to believe that Wittgenstein did not really mean, was not absolutely serious about what is said in the book and its preface. To do that, one had to take seriously his statements about seeing the world rightly, one of the last remarks in the Tractatus, and about ethics not being in the world, which might seem to clash with proposition one in Tractatus, that the world is everything that is the case. In other words, Wittgenstein apparently had two worlds, if not two lives. The remainder of my talk is made up of reflections and comments on four points taken subjectively from the philosophy and life of Wittgenstein, presented in their order of appearance in his life. As I see them, all four points have links to question to the two questions, one and two, Q1 and Q2, that I just showed you. Here are the two next. While he was working on the Tractatus and for some time afterwards, I don't know quite how long, Wittgenstein was of the opinion that it is actually possible to solve certain philosophical problems once and for all. And in some sense, if possible to solve, in a sense, all philosophical problems. And that he had in fact done so. That's what it says straightforwardly in the preface. I quote from the preface of the Tractatus. The truth, emphasized, the truth of the thoughts communicated here in the Tractatus seems to me unassailable and definitive. I am, therefore, of the opinion that the problems have in essentials been finally solved. The absence of modesty from this statement is striking. It does not become less striking if we take these finally solved problems to be restricted to those philosophical problems that were recognized in Vienna and Cambridge and Uppsala and Berlin too, although not quite to the same extent, as genuine problems and not mere pseudo problems. For then, in a sense, if it is so that all the truths of the Tractatus are unassailable and definitive, then he had also done away with and gotten rid of, and if not solved, the philosophical problems of all other philosophers. This, as many of you know, is an echo of the school, the Wienerkreis, den logiske positivismen. It might follow from this, then, that there would be no more use for philosophers. There were no more problems to solve. Not that his life had, therefore, to come to an end, although my philosophy is my life, nor that it ought to come to an end. But his subsequent non-philosophical life, therefore, ought to change radically. And it did, as we know. We all know also that after a while, the philosophical problems he thought he had unassailably solved refused to lie down for good. His new philosophical life was in fact not very long, measured in years, a good 20 years, from 1929, roughly, to 1951 when he died, with not so good 5 years of war thrown in. His own preface to what came to be known as Philosophische Untersuchungen is dated January 1949. 1945, some 6 months before the end of World War II, and some 9 months before the first atomic bomb was exploded. And that preface to the Philosophical Investigations also suggests that now he had come to the end of his philosophical tether. The time, I quote, "The time is past in which I could improve it. But once more, the philosopher was resuscitated. I'm thinking of Ibn Gilly's site, Uncertainties, the last thing he wrote." There are passages in the Philosophical Investigations which suggest that his concern with philosophy is now painfully compulsive. I'm not suggesting that his philosophical concern in the Spectator's period was not in fact compulsive. The manuscript carried it along with him, if I'm not mistaken. In fact, here, the manuscript survived the First World War along with the carrier, with its carrier. But at that time, he could at least try to follow the logic of his own philosophy by ceasing to be a philosopher. In particular, I'm struck, we're in the philosophical investigation, I'm in the philosophical investigations now. In particular, I'm struck by some statements in Philosophical Investigations, number 133, the first part, that seem to me to call for attention, and I quote again, "The real discovery, Entdeckung, the German word is the one that makes me capable of stopping doing philosophy when I want to." He doesn't say, not when I have solved my problems, but when I want. Not when I have solved problems this time, but when I want to. The one that gives, I'll do that again, my added comments. Here it is again. "The real discovery is the one that makes me capable of stopping doing philosophy when I want to. The one that gives philosophy peace, so that it is no longer tormented by questions which bring itself into question. The German text there is von Fragen gepeitscht, and to one who knows Norwegian, tormented does not conjure up the visions that the original German gepeitscht does. But with this translates very neatly into Norwegian, pisket. Or in English, whip to whip, to beat, to flog, to lash. That's more specific than being tormented. Is this discovery that he talks about here something that philosophy cannot now give him? In contrast to what his philosophy used to be able to do for him in the Tractatus period. Did the questions of the Tractatus whip or flog him in a way that made him want to stop doing philosophy? Doesn't seem to me that he did. Why does he use the word discovery or Entdeckung? As if there were something out there waiting to be found, an insight perhaps, that escapes him. Did he consider to stop doing philosophy? Is it, or maybe? All right, it is, or maybe all right, simply to say, I have changed my mind. That's sometimes perfectly good, and all you need to say. If you're a credible person, at times, when there are good reasons against one's view, there is even some kind of moral and methodological duty to do so, to change one's mind. it is hardly unreasonable to say that Wittgenstein's fealty was under some such moral obligation, a cognitive or intellectual moral obligation, if you will, to change his mind about certain ideas in Spectatus, especially, as he says himself, in the light of Sraffa's criticism, as he relates in the preface to the Philosophical Investigations. From an ethics point of view, this comes close, as I see it, this comes close to the heart of the matter of moral philosophy. Perhaps, but here I'm uncertain, of any philosophy, and to the heart of the matter of a morally decent non-philosophical life as well. Could we say then that Wittgenstein would have been inconsistent, a logical word, to not abandon some of the central ideas and the Tractatus, or that it was consistent of him then to change his mind about not doing philosophy anymore? The quotation I refer to here, it doesn't say that he has changed his mind about it, but there's a note of regret, as it were, when he says the time has passed, but I can prove it. I'm sure that in ordinary language we do apply the notion of consistency, and especially, perhaps, its negation, inconsistency, about human acts and behavior. But I'm not sure that in moral contexts, consistency and inconsistency mean the same as in formal logic. If or when you stop doing philosophy, then you have to do something else. There's no such thing as doing nothing. For most of us, to find something else to do is difficult, if not impossible, after a certain age. And few would call that sort of practical imperative that you're then under, few would call that imperative a calling. These speculations led me on to a different aspect. There are other situations where consistency in action is more problematic than Wittgenstein's changing both his mind and his conduct and mode of life. As, in one sense, a consequence of his philosophy, his own philosophy. I'm thinking of Heidegger and Narcissism. In Humanity, the book, Humanity, a Moral History of the 20th Century, title I very much like. By Jonathan Glover, or Glover, I don't know how I pronounce his name. In Glover's book, which came in 1999, he discusses the case of Heidegger, and I quote, "Is it possible to put aside Heidegger and the man and to consider only Heidegger the philosopher? What are the links between the two? There is probably no 20th century philosopher about whom opinion is more divided." And I skip a few passages, few sentences. But his admirers, I mean among the admirers of Heidegger, include Jean-Paul Sartre, Hannah Arendt, Richard Rorty, and George Steiner. It's not difficult for Norwegians to recognize the problem I talked about. We've had exactly the same sort of thing with Knut Hamsun, the Nobel laureate for literature. Glover goes on to ask, did Heidegger's Nazism grow out of his philosophy, of the philosophy? The moral case, I'm still quoting, the moral case against Heidegger, the man, is obvious. It is not about a link. No, sorry. The moral case against Heidegger, the man, against Heidegger, the man, is obvious. The central moral case against Heidegger, the philosopher, is easier to get wrong. It is not about the link between his theories and his life. It is about undermining philosophy's role in developing a climate of critical thought. Karl Jaspers was right, says Glover, in seeing this incommunicative mode of thought as linked to being dictatorial. We could also ask then whether an acceptable moral philosophy today ought to favor a political commitment to democracy, in some broad sense of that term. Of democracy as a required or preferred principle of political philosophy, or perhaps less demanding, there are certain political moral principles which it could never be legitimate for an acceptable moral philosophy to accept and promote. For instance, the kind of racism that was both preached and practiced in Hitler's one-man dictatorship. In general, any political moral principle that is incompatible with the most basic human rights. Are they the sort of thing we would be supposed to say? No. As in a philosophy. A free transnational dialogue does indeed seem to presuppose and implement some such political moral principles. Case in point is this connecting, is this assembly. In academic political science circles today, I suppose we all, most of us know anyway, there is currently a very lively discussion about such things as this. In philosophical investigations, the confident mood which dominates in Tractatus, so clearly stated in its preface, seems to me replaced in philosophical investigation by a mood of resignation and pessimism. In the preface to Investigations, he says, it is not impossible that it should fall to the lot of this work in its poverty and in the darkness of this time to bring light into one brain or another, but of course it is not likely. No more talk here about solving philosophical problems, and no belief in the possibility that this new philosophy, which had tormented the philosopher, could nevertheless benefit others. My question too, and so did, asks what can or cannot a philosopher's philosophy do for others? And this is the point where that kind of question becomes particularly relevant for a moral philosophy that wants to be normative. My moral philosophy wants to be normative. Any medical ethics that worth its salt wants to, has to be normative. And any political science today that wants to be, what's the word, under some kind of imperative. For a normative moral philosophy is one that evaluates and judges human actions and or offers advice, counsel, guidance to whomever reads or hears it. I don't know whether this kind of query that I'm raising up, let alone, is relevant, let alone tormenting for all, at all for most philosophers. It is difficult to see how it could be for two disagreeing philosophers. I know it is for some, for Jonathan Glover, for instance, in an interview Yes, I have the date, but I don't have the clipping. In 1979, in Times Higher Education Supplement, Grover was interviewed, and the interview was printed under the heading Socratic Empathy. He said that he would feel uneasy, a very modest way of putting his point, that he said that he would feel uneasy by living the privileged life of an academic if this life as an academic made no difference to others, because it would an academic life to it. If his life as an academic, I must have made some sort of mistake. And of course, not just any difference. If it's going to be a difference that we wouldn't feel very uneasy about philosophically or remote, a difference for the better. Q2 asks, as I just said, what can or cannot the philosopher's philosophy do to or for others? There are three, these are my reflections now. There are three possible answers when it comes to making a difference to others. So this is very close to the heart of the material world of philosophy. The first outcome is that it makes no difference at all to those who are exposed to it or hear about it. That outcome is usually called indifference. Oh, we can't, it just passes. Doesn't really mean anything to you. Or second, it could be in some sense good or useful to those that are exposed to it. And the third alternative is that the philosopher's philosophy could be harmful to others. In most cases, and for most persons, it is probably the indifference alternative that is the outcome, which may be all right if it is acceptable to argue that, on the whole, indifference is better than being harmful. But you can also choose an interpretation which has more clout, namely, that that do no harm, that's a quotation from medical ethics, is in fact an important norm in medical ethics, old and new. Now to alternative two. Let's see what it's coming up. Yes. This is sticky. Here are the nicely, here's your choice. It is a very old belief in our culture that philosophy, and not only the history of philosophy, is so important that teaching it ought to be in some sense obligatory. It was considered obligatory in the Middle Ages, and still is now in our own days. Teaching and studying philosophy, as I see it, is a perennial transnational project in our cultures and in several other civilizations as well. The third possibility is that philosophy could be harmful. The history of our flourishing, the history of our flourishing institutions of higher learning seem to tell us that we have been reluctant to think so, that it could be harmful. Philosophy has always been on the curriculum of our universities. This is not to deny the possibility that one particular philosopher's philosophy has been, or still is, or is considered harmful to some particular individual or group. The logical postulate ethics was considered harmful by many people. I don't think it was, but it was very, very seriously considered dangerously harmful in all the Scandinavian countries and in the early 40s, in the late 40s, and long after that too. So that's, to put it on home ground, as it were. Could this then, that it's possible, that, to be harmful, that philosophy could be harmful. Could it be true of a philosopher who is widely held to be one of the most, if not the most, influential philosopher of the 20th century? After Wittgenstein's death, Gilbert Ryle wrote an obituary, I don't have the clipping any longer, that Wittgenstein had been a philosopher, a philosophical genius and a pedagogical disaster. When I knew him, Wittgenstein, in 1950, I asked him why he had resigned from his Cambridge chair only a couple of years ago. And he answered, I quote, "Because there are only two or three of my students about whom I could say, I do not know I have done them any harm. I do not know that I have done them any harm." When I asked him if Van Wright was one of them, he said yes. I did not ask for the names of the one or two others. Now, a few concluding remarks. What is it then to be a philosopher, with or against your will? That question probably has no simple answer in contradistinction to asking what it is to be a physician, a lawyer, a teacher, a linguist, or an engineer, an auto mechanic. The beginnings of an answer to that question might be that to be a philosopher is not to have a profession like that of a medical doctor or a barrister. Perhaps it could be to have a calling or vocation. I'm not quite sure of exactly what that term vocation can cover. Von Wright, however, uses the expression calling Swedish kallelse in the book I've quoted from before, when at age 13 he knew that he was going to be a philosopher, that he had to become a philosopher. If Socrates is the model, it was Gulliver who brought Socrates up, it certainly seems hard to think of it as a profession. And if it were a philosophical therapy of sorts, it might be more like psychiatry or clinical psychology than any other profession. In Norway at present, we have a group of mostly young philosophers who advertise their services and themselves as counsels on a fee-for-service basis, to use the medical expression. Apparently there is now a demand on the market for philosophers, and not only in Norway. I'm fairly sure that some philosophers see that as a sign of decay, or some kind of moral decay. I don't think I do. I'm not sure what I do. But should they see that, or should we see that as a sign of decay, if we are moral philosophers who want to be of some use to others? Nothing I have said in this talk should be read. Nothing I've said in this talk should be read as an attempt to answer questions about the real meaning of Wittgenstein's life and philosophy. Of course not. And I've not tried to say anything worth saying about what it is to be a philosopher, or even less about what philosophy is. I've tried to become clearer in my own mind about certain problems, philosophy in general, and moral philosophy in particular. Knowing and reading Wittgenstein have made these problems more urgent to me, because they may be of interest, I'm lying, at least partly because they may be of interest and concern to end. Obviously, I hope, but it's not the case. It's a fact. While preparing this talk, I rediscovered and found support, perhaps even consolation, in von Wright's concluding remark in the biographical sketch, which he wrote for Norman Malcolm's memoirs of Wittgenstein, which first appeared in 1958. And I quote what von Wright was saying. I have sometimes thought that what makes a man's work classic is often just this multiplicity, which invites and at the same time resists our craving for clear understanding. Thank you.